Welcome to Sabbatical 101. My name is Bethany Walensky, and I'm an associate professor at Michigan State University. I had a life-changing sabbatical, and I'm on a mission to help fellow academics do the same. This podcast is a resource for all things academic sabbaticals. Each episode will provide you with inspiration and insight into the sabbatical planning process, regardless of your institution, discipline, length of sabbatical, or where you plan to sabbatical. I'm so excited to have you along for the ride.
This week, my guest is Professor Leslie Wong, an award-winning author, writing coach, and publishing strategist. She created Your Words Unleashed to help women scholars develop the practical strategies and unshakable self-confidence to become a published author and one who thrives every step of the way. In this episode, Leslie shares tips for getting more writing done during sabbatical and provides insight into how working with a coach can support your sabbatical writing goals and your career goals. I really enjoyed this wide-ranging conversation with Leslie, and I hope you do too. Here it is. Hi, Leslie. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Bethany.
So I'm really excited to talk to you today about the writing coaching services you provide to academics or other scholarly authors. But before we dive into that, could you just take a moment to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are right now and what you're up to?
Absolutely. So my name is Leslie Wong. I am a qualitative sociologist by training. I graduated from UC Berkeley in 2010, did the whole thing, a postdoc, two tenure track positions. I ended up earning tenure at University of Massachusetts, Boston. And the year I went up for tenure, I also trained as a life coach and started considering other possibilities outside of the academy. And then, of course, COVID hit and I had a child. And 4 years later, I was at a point where I had built my coaching business. Well, there's sort of a little bit in between. So I got trained and then I decided, hey, maybe I could actually do this as a side hustle. So that's how a lot of people kind of get into coaching. And then I started coaching a lot of women scholars on various aspects of their lives and their careers. But one of the things that our sessions really seemed to center on was writing. And writing was something, like many people, I had a lot of a very love or hate relationship with. But I had also written two sole authored books that I had published with scholarly presses. And I was like, you know, I have a lot to say about writing because my first book was a tortuous experience, as it is for a lot of folks. And then the second one was much, much, much smoother, much easier. And I was just a different person and a different scholar with a different set of tools and self-confidence by that point. And I was like, well, maybe I can develop a process around this. And then I started taking steps to create my own coaching business around writing. So that's where I am now. I left the academy in August of 2022 to focus full time on my business, which is called Your Words Unleashed. And I also have a podcast called Your Words Unleashed, which Bethany is going to be on as well.
It's a great podcast. I've been listening to it a lot. And it's just, you provide so much helpful insight into publishing and just a whole host of other kind of issues within the academy.
Thank you so much. Yeah. So I'm excited to be here and talk about any aspect of writing while on sabbatical or just sort of generally approaching the academic career, you know, in a more sustainable way.
Yeah. And I think sustainability, I mean, that's such a key thing that comes up. And I find that so many people who come to me to talk about sabbaticals, like that's something they're concerned about. The trajectory they're on kind of pre-tenure, because most people I work with have just earned tenure and they're going into their first sabbatical and they just feel like they've been on the hamster wheel and it's this kind of like publish or perish lifestyle is not sustainable for them. And so I would love to hear you talk more about that as we hear about your programs. Like, how can we think about doing the work that I think often people love and are very passionate about, but sometimes that gets eroded when you're just constantly trying to produce in an unsustainable way.
I completely agree with you. And I think ultimately, like everything for me comes back to core values. And so those qualities that when they're very present in our lives, we feel like we are much more aligned and purposeful. And I think one thing that academics often do, and maybe just people in general, but especially academics who feel very mission-driven, is we assume we know what our core values are, and we assume that our institutions also agree with our values.
Yes.
And what ends up happening is that there is quite a mismatch for most folks, but I think especially women and other minoritized faculty come into it and they're like, wait a second, I don't feel like I'm honoring the best parts of myself in this job. Productivity seems to be ranked higher than community. And I'm not sure if I'm really being authentic here, but I'm going to do everything I can to get tenure. So that hamster wheel thing of like, I'm going to sacrifice everything, including my health and my relationships, because tenure is that marker or that milestone where I can finally relax and then become who I'm really meant to be. It's sort of like, I don't know. I think there's that kind of ideology around tenure is like, that's kind of a key to happiness. That's a moment when you can finally be more genuine or something, or do the things you want to do. And the thing is that if it's been unsustainable until tenure, there's no reason that tenure is going to actually start making things more sustainable for you. People will just find, you'll just be asked to do more stuff, right? So if you haven't done a lot of reflection, and sabbatical is a great time to do this reflection, but you know, really thinking about like, what are the things that truly inspire and motivate me on an internal level? And how do I make sure that those things are front and center moving forward? That's pretty much the only way to not get burnt out. And then beyond that, because, you know, it's both a good and a bad thing, but there's so much in the academy that does align with people's values that, and they can still burn out doing the things that they value. So right. Then there's another layer of, let me actually look through all of the places where my time and energy is being expended and start to prioritize amongst those two, because I literally can't do everything. If I do, I'm spread too thin. If I do, I don't actually reach the goals that I want to reach. A lot of times I'm doing stuff that's helping other people reach their goals, and that feels good. But when it push comes to shove, like I want to get my book done. I want to get these articles out. I want to get this grant. Right. So there's multiple layers of reflection that I think need to happen. But, and then a lot of just putting down hard limits that can feel very uncomfortable for folks that are usually taking on more rather than taking things off. So, you know, how that ties back into sabbaticals, it's finally a time where you can put things down and you can look at them from with some amount of objectivity and reassess.
Yeah. And I also think what I'm learning about sabbaticals is it's hard to do that. Sometimes it takes being so burned out that you just can't move forward to really force people to relax. At least that was kind of in my case. It was just like, I had nothing else to give. But I do have clients who are like, I need to ease into some rest, but I also have these projects that I really care about and I want to move forward. And so that's where I would love to hear about your programs, because I love this idea of kind of alignment of values. And from, you know, looking at your website and listening to your podcast, I get the sense that you're not just helping academics write the book, right? You know, like anyone can help you just get the book written, but you're focused on why am I writing this book? Who do I expect to read it? And how is this kind of aligned with my own mission and vision as an academic? So could you tell me a little bit more about what kinds of services you offer to scholarly writers?
Yes, the primary program, so sort of what's called the signature program of my coaching, is the Your Words Unleashed 6-month program for scholarly writers. Primarily, I would say I work with women faculty members who are working on their first books, but I have a number of folks who are working on their second books, and also men or transgender folks, right? So it's not just limited. And a lot of folks just working on articles as well, because writing is writing is writing. That's it. Books are, you know, their own special kind of beast, and that you have to tame in different ways. A lot of time it's where the coaching comes in. It's a lot of mindset work around beliefs about yourself as a scholar, beliefs about your writing, identifying areas where you're getting stuck and finding ways to reframe your thoughts or beliefs or ideas so that you can move forward also sustainably, right? So what is a feasible writing schedule look like versus an aspirational one? Who, you know, I work with people a lot on like who do they actually want to talk to if we remove other experts from the mix, right? If you don't question who you're writing for, people sort of unfailingly try to write for reviewer number two, then they get stuck because their inner critic is so activated. And instead, we work on writing for your biggest fans, right? What is it that you want to say if you were truly in dialogue with people that care about this stuff? They're already on board. They just want to learn more. They are not experts in this, but they could do something with the information. And what is it that you want people to eventually do with it, right? What kinds of transformations do you want to see your work make? And also knowing that your book is ideally going to have all kinds of ramifications and consequences and changes out in the world that you can't possibly predict right now, but it has to get out there. Right. So what I help people do is really kind of see themselves as a conduit or like a channel for these ideas. And that the book is really something that you're partnering with, right? Mm-hmm. That the book has its own life that it needs to live. And you're there to like get it down on paper in the best possible, most accessible and engaging form, and also rigorous, right? But that's so it can live its life out in the world. That's kind of how I treat any kind of writing coaching, is like truly what kind of impact do you want this to make? And then of course, there's a lot around actual strategies and time management and, you know, experimenting. Like a lot of people come to me, they don't even know what their peak work hours are because they are so used to working all the time. Like, yeah. They don't even notice, right? Or like, what do you want to be doing when you're not working is a big question. They're like, when am I not working? There's nothing I can, right? So there's a lot of that kind of like more holistic approach that we take. But ideally, within a 6-month period, people will gain a sense of momentum and direction. And I feel like once you have those things, you can actually see something like a book through. Mm-hmm. And of course, I work with people sometimes for years on end because books really take a long time. But yeah, ultimately, you know, it's around finding a sense of ease while accepting and acknowledging that writing is difficult. So it's got sort of like holding that paradox at the same time, and also having some discernment, being able to tell when you as an individual are making the writing even harder than it needs to be. And then having strategies and tools to make it, you know, to allow it to be as hard as it's supposed to be. And sometimes it's actually not that hard. It just depends on the day. So, right. So there's a lot of sort of mental reframing that goes into that process as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like obviously this is would be helpful at any point in one's career. Just this idea. I love how it's this more holistic look at writing and not just, you know, do more and more and more, but really like, why are you doing this? Who is it for? What is the work that you want your scholarship to do in the world? It sounds like the skills people develop and the insights they get from the 6 months of working with you, they can then carry that forward into like, it's really, it sounds like about changing mindset and habits so that then they're kind of prepared to move into their future writing projects in a more grounded and sustainable way.
Ideally, yeah.
And some of us will need more time than others, of course.
Everybody needs constant reinforcement of these things, including myself.
Yeah, the habits that I think we get into, we get so well trained in the academy. And so I talk a lot to my clients about like the muscle memory of just working all the time. It's actually really hard to like change that.
Right, right. Or seeing like rest as a necessary component of healthy productivity. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a whole movement around rest as resistance, right? Because yeah. It's not just the academy. I mean, it's capitalism in general, but I think that that's been very much co-opted by the academy of just more and more and more. And, you know, if people don't have a very grounded sense of themselves, conflating one's personal identity with their publication record or yes. with external measures of productivity. Like I said, like that's a value of the academy that I think most people don't actually hold when they enter the academy. And there can be a real conflict there that comes out through people feeling guilty when they're not working or regretting not having worked more. Or a lot of people spend a lot of time berating themselves for being where they're at. Right. So a lot of folks come to me and they're like, this book should have been out 2 years ago, and not realizing that number one, you're resisting what actually is, which is like the situation right now. Number two, it actually takes a lot of energy to feel guilty and to regret things versus like, can we channel it some of that forward into the things that you actually want to do? But also it means sometimes relighting a flame under, you know, like fanning the flames of a project that's been sitting around for a decade. It's hard to get back into those things sometimes. It's a lot easier to do other stuff that's more, you know, current and exciting to you. But sometimes you have to go back to that dissertation from 12 years ago and just got to do it if you want to move forward. So, you know, there's a lot of various strategies you have to employ there too.
Yeah. When I think about sabbaticals and productivity and how those get tied up, kind of going back to your comment about capitalism and the kind of work more and more and the way that the academy reflects that and perpetuates that, I think sabbaticals too have gone from like the original purpose of a sabbatical was actually rest and, you know, to kind of rejuvenate yourself so you come back and you can do the challenging intellectual work. We're creating knowledge as scholars that requires a lot of energy. And I think, you know, I look at like the sabbatical application that I had to fill out for my institution. They don't want to know how I'm going to rest and become more creative.
No.
They want to know what I'm going to produce, right?
Of course.
So it's like this, the neoliberal sabbatical, right? That's all about being a more and more productive worker. And so, yeah, this is one of the things that I work with my clients on is detaching from that vision or realizing you can have a purpose for your sabbatical that's not attached to the products that your institution wants.
Yes. And actually, I think what's counterintuitive about that, and which I talk about a lot, is that the more you lean into who you want to be now, work or otherwise, right? But like the more you really live into your values in various aspects of your life in different ways, the more likely you are to actually achieve those tangible outcomes at the end. Because it's not so much of this graspy quality of like desperation. I have to do that. If I don't get those, like those things show me that I'm worthy versus living a worthy life on a daily basis and knowing what that looks like to you during work hours and during non-work hours. But again, the burnout can make it very, very difficult for people to do any kind of reflection, which is why most of the folks I work with who are on sabbatical do have to spend the first 2 to 3 months decompressing. And then usually feel some amount of guilt over it.
I have a client who has a year-long sabbatical coming up, and she just decided that she's going to not work for the first half or focus on scholarly productivity. And she is a poet. And so she wants to make space for the creative writing. So she is going to be doing creative writing, but not kind of the, you know, revise and resubmit of the journal article kind of thing. I was so excited for her when she decided that, but that's a really radical thing for someone to say, I'm just going to take 4 or 5 months completely off to rest and trust that I will get back into it. And I think, like you said, hopefully in a way that's more aligned. I think when you're living in alignment with your values, things feel a bit easier. Like there's less friction there. There's less tension.
And I think there's more intention. And so I think like what your client is saying is, you know, she's making promises to herself ahead of time that are in line with her values. I mean, I feel like most people who would probably seek out a sabbatical coach already do quite a bit of self-reflection. And they're like, I just would love to have somebody else there to help me, you know, see this, give me more of a bird's eye view, but also like hold me accountable to the things that I say that I want to do or not do versus. And then again, you get people who, you know, halfway through are coming to you and they're like, I'm not using this time in the way that I wanted to. And that's also an experience that I've had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when I think about your program and kind of what I see people wanting to use their sabbatical for, it just seems like it could be such a great opportunity. Many people are seeing their sabbatical as a time to reflect on their career. It's like the time to stop, take a breath, and say, okay, what have I been doing? And what projects do I want to keep moving forward? Which ones do I want to leave behind? What do I need to start saying no to? And so it feels to me like someone who really wanted to kind of figure out their writing, but it sounds like what you do is not just about we're going to get the writing project done. It's much bigger than that. So it could be a great time to work with you to chart a course for scholarship moving forward, you know, maybe get some things done on sabbatical. And I have lots of clients who are like, okay, just need to get these couple articles written, or I need to write this book proposal. But then also they do that, but then they're thinking ahead, like, okay, how do I carry this forward after my sabbatical?
For sure. And, you know, I also want to mention that I do a fair amount of career coaching as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of book coaching a lot of times. But then sometimes people will come to me and they're like, I want a combination of writing coaching and career coaching, because they don't necessarily need me to read their stuff. I might be just totally such a non-expert that it's not helpful, or they just have a lot of peer support colleagues that, mm-hmm. you know, will read their stuff. But they're like, but I need to get on track. I need to figure out my goals. I need to feel better about this. I need someone to hold me accountable. And so a lot of times, like, yeah, I feel like the clarification of who you are as a person, as a scholar, that goes hand in hand with like the goals, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned sometimes people are working on projects that are outside your area of expertise. Do you work with academics in any discipline, or is your coaching discipline specific?
Definitely not discipline specific. I probably currently, or, you know, I think last year I did, like, I actually counted it all up. I had folks from like 25 different disciplines.
Oh, wow.
But they are primarily based in the social sciences and humanities, just because I'm a sociologist by training. I do have a few clients through Princeton University Press. They've got a diversity fellowship where we help people produce book proposals, and they will send me folks from various disciplines. So, you know, I have someone in mathematics, a couple people in biology, and the difference for them is they tend to be writing more public facing books, so more crossover type of books. And so in some ways it can almost be a little bit easier for a scientist who tends to do, you know, math equations or, you know, that sort of thing in their journal article writing. And then they have to translate it over into a book. It's such a radical shift that in some ways it might be easier than folks that are coming from the humanities and social sciences, where they kind of assume like my article writing and my book writing are the same. And I'm like, no, they're not. They don't have the same audience. And they're like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, you want to think about with a book, how do you widen it up? How do you make sure that you are as inclusive and accessible as possible so that you don't lose people, say, with the title alone?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, write it in such a way that like, it doesn't assume people know too much, right? So finding that balance between I can trust that my reader is an educated, curious person, but not assuming that they know anything about this field, or even if they do, it's okay, because that's a real minority of folks. And I'm not dumbing things down. I'm just making it clear.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can do that with any topic in any field. And sometimes humanities and social scientists have the hardest time doing that, I would say. I think knowing who you're writing for and what's the purpose, and, you know, like sometimes you just have to write articles. Some people really like writing articles, and for other folks, it's just straight up like what you have to do to play the game. Mm-hmm. And then the book is where you can really be yourself. But then what does that mean? Who are you? How do you want to come across? If you're telling me your ideal reader is your mom or like your friend from childhood who's just curious about the world, and what you're giving me to read is still for reviewer number two, like then there's some work to be done there. And so, yeah, like I'm trying to tie this back to sabbatical in some way.
It doesn't have to totally tie back to sabbatical. I'm sure listeners can make that connection if they've got a writing project.
But I feel like a lot of people do want to work with me when they have a significant period off from teaching. So it may not be sabbatical, but they have course releases or someone, you know, they might be on a Fulbright. So they're doing a bunch of other stuff, but they've got this kind of freedom and flexibility with their schedule that they don't normally have, or they have a pre-tenure sabbatical, which look a lot different, I think, from post-tenure sabbaticals. But I think thinking about our conversation when I interviewed you for my podcast, I think the more intentional I think you can be around knowing you want to take some dedicated rest time in the beginning, the better. So if folks know that they have 5 months off, they could probably take the first 4 or 5 weeks just completely off, maybe 6 weeks, and just be like, I'm giving myself permission. I have a plan, right? Mm-hmm. And I have accountability for that plan when I restart. So like just knowing, like building that sense of self-trust, and then you can fully let go. Because I think there's a lot of tension involved, at least for me, when I used to be on break, between enjoying myself and feeling massively pressured to be working mm-hmm. while I was enjoying myself. And I'm like, that just completely detracts from enjoying yourself. Yeah. Because I wasn't working and I knew I wasn't going to work. So right. if you,
you can constantly feel the guilt of not working, or you see the to-do list looming, right?
It just saps your energy, but number two, makes you very non-present with what is actually happening in front of you. Yeah. And so I think actually demarcating a certain amount of time for like, not going to worry about it. Like I'm going to sleep all day. Like I don't, doesn't matter, right? I can yeah. do whatever I want. And then it's like a Rumspringa, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or like there's some dedicated period of time where you can like do what you want, right? You're free to do what you want. And then you're going to get back to business because then you've, you know, replenished yourself.
Yes.
And maybe not fully even, but in a dedicated way you can't normally otherwise do.
And I think what makes people nervous about that is the idea that like, maybe if I stop, I'm not going to be able to get started again. I think what people don't realize is that sometimes like front loading the rest, like resting at the beginning, you can probably be more productive and get like, let's say you have 5 months for your sabbatical and you take the first month off, you'll probably get more done in those remaining 4 months if you rest for the first month than if you try to push through the whole time.
Totally.
But I don't think we often, that's really hard to believe, I think, especially when you're really burned out and stressed.
Yeah. And I think this is, I'm on a like crusade against black or white thinking, right? Mm-hmm. It's either this or that, right or wrong. I can either be fully productive or I'm totally lazy. I'm never going to get off the couch. And it's always something in the middle. And yeah. we need to trust that we have an internal motivator for our quote unquote productivity. Because I think as much as I tirade against the academy or capitalism for producing this like culture of never enoughness and always having to do more and more and more, at the same time, I believe that it's human nature to want to create.
Yeah.
We want to do things. We want to bring things into the world. For many of us, it's producing new ideas. And that feels good in and of itself. And if it can get you further along in your career, awesome. Like those things don't have to be at odds. And I do think that if you've rested in a very sort of, you've just given yourself permission to like have a delicious, nurturing, excessive kind of rest, which for some people is like 3 days, but like, you know, really yeah. big at the beginning of a sabbatical, then you're probably going to get back in touch with that part of you that's like, let's do it. Let's get back to work. Let's do these things I really care about because I'm clear-headed again.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I'm just thinking of is another outcome of that rest might be a sabbatical might be a time that you realize that maybe being in academia is not aligned with your values and long-term vision, right? And I think that's okay. It's okay to, or, you know, I started my business during my sabbatical. And like you said, it creates this opening to say there's something else I want to put out into the world. And now feels like a good time to do it. And so I think it can be very scary to be on, you know, especially if you've gotten tenure. I imagine you can relate. It's very scary to say like, maybe this isn't what I want, to allow that thought to creep in. Dang. I think sometimes, like I think about this with grief, for example, you know, it's easy to not grieve, like to keep yourself busy and then you never think about the person that you lost and you can kind of ignore it, but mm-hmm. it's there somewhere and it's going to pop up. Right. And so
oh, for sure.
I think part of what can be scary about rest and slowing down is if you are having these thoughts of this isn't kind of the direction I want to go in anymore, that could come up on sabbatical. And then,
I think it comes up for people on a daily basis, not on sabbatical.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, not a good job market in it, you know, academic and now non-academic, right? So it's even yeah. scarier. There's even more uncertainty. And, you know, typically what I tell people is that there are satisfying paths forward no matter where you are, usually, mm-hmm. unless it's like such a toxic, dysfunctional environment that it's never going to work. But for a lot of folks, it's somewhere in between. And then it becomes about radical selfishness. How do you make sure and engineer your work life so that it is in total, as much as possible, alignment with your values? So it's not like, oh, I'm going to be really selfish and therefore not do the work anymore. It's more like the selfishness is more like, I'm going to do the work that I care about. And for a lot of folks, that's like being a really kick-ass teacher when teaching is not the thing that gets you all the accolades on your campus, but you're going to do it anyway because it's really, really important to you. And just ensuring that you're not just living for the institution. I think it's much more accepted now to talk about leaving academia, to talk about how, you know, work won't love you back, institutions, HR, it's like not on your side, right?
Yeah.
But who's advocating for you? Ultimately, you have to be the one to advocate for yourself in the ways that are possible. And I think that's where having some clarity around like, who am I in and outside of this space so that if you do ultimately leave academia, there's not like a huge identity crisis. And I say that having gone through a whole identity crisis. So this is not an easy thing to avoid. But I think times like sabbatical are really good to help you reengage with like, who do you want to be moving forward, regardless of the workspace that you're actually in? What kind of work do you want to be doing? How do you want to, at this point, how do we want to be part of this resistance against what's happening? What does that look like? What role do you want to play? How does your work fall into that? So that, you know, because I think right now a lot of folks are just really like, why am I doing all of this glacial peer-reviewed work when the world is on fire? And I think that, okay, if you have a break, take some time to reflect.
Yeah.
What are some other ways that you can actually utilize your ideas and your passion for this stuff in ways that have impact that's more immediate?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sabbatical is a great time to tap into your non-scholarly identity. And it's, at least for me, I was not the same person after my sabbatical as I was going into it because I totally shifted my priorities. I kind of got things back to where they needed to be. Like you said, detaching from this academic identity is really hard. And I still have those voices that are like, you should have published this or you should have done this. But then I can ask myself, but should I have? Who's demanding that of me? And I realized that is my own expectation. And of course, you know, I have the luxury of having tenure. So I'm not working, but I don't have the same pressures. But if I want to work with teachers in Tanzania on their professional development, and that's not going to lead to as many publications, that's okay. But that's in alignment, you know, so it's just silencing my inner critic a lot about all the shoulds that I, you know, that are still there. So I think it's a constant struggle, even though I feel very confident in where I want to go. It's hard to get rid of that feeling like you're not doing enough.
And I don't think the point is to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's true.
I think it's more just like recognize that it's there and that it's not the same as you. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes people's inner critic is like their parent or like a harsh advisor or supervisor. Mm-hmm. Or it's just sort of this disembodied voice of the academy. I don't know. Now that I'm not in the academy anymore, I don't have nearly as much of an inner critic. So that says something.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because who am I comparing myself to? Because it's a comparison game always in academia. And so I think that that's always like, you know, I'm falling behind. And even like, you know, if I know, like I knew this one professor that was sort of on the top, like really at the top of his game. And he was always afraid of not being at the top of his game. I'm like, there's never any happiness in this.
Yeah, you can't even enjoy it. It's like getting tenure. It feels anticlimactic. You've worked so hard and you think something will significantly shift, but no one is going to shift things for you. I think that's what, if you want things to feel different post-tenure, you have to make it different.
Exactly. And it also means doing some investigation of yourself that can feel uncomfortable to a lot of folks. And so they don't do it. And then things continue on. Like, Tenure does not change people's habits. If anything, a lot of folks dig in even harder to the overwork and then they're not happy about it, right? But I feel like, you know, anytime along the way you can stop and reflect and uncover a lot of stuff, but also know that uncovering that could also lead you to question your path as well. So just being aware. And for some folks, like for me, like I had to do it because I was having this massive crisis pre-tenure of just, what am I doing? Is this really the work I want to be doing? Am I having the impact I want to have? I don't feel like I am. Like, why is, you know, why am I suffering so much sort of in my head, like when I'm so privileged in all these other areas, right? So I just had to get some clarity. But yeah, I think the more clarity you can gain on like, why are you doing this? Yeah. And maybe you want to start treating it as more of a job and less of a calling. And maybe that's the sustainable path forward. And what does that actually look like?
And how do you then identify what that looks like and then create and hold the boundaries? Because no one's going to hold boundaries for you if you decide, well, for me, that means working 9 to 5.
Right.
No one's going to stop emailing you at 8 p.m. It's up to you to not check your email or to not respond to email, right?
Yeah. And I do know that, like, you know, since I left the academy, well, I would say 2020 was where my head was really like, I'm definitely leaving. So that was always what I was moving towards. I think faculty workloads have gone up by a lot because I was only teaching 1 year post-COVID. And that was enough for me to be like, I got to go. This is not even what it was before when I was feeling like I was drowning. So I also recognize that. So that's the tough thing about boundaries is you can have all the boundaries you want and there's still going to be cracks in them probably. Mm-hmm. But I do have a lot of my clients will say, you'd be so proud of me because my dean emailed me to be on this committee, this task force, and it would have taken up a ton of time. And I told them no, you know, like I'm just like standing up for what I know to be important, which is my work. I have to get my work done, you know, and they know that too. Deans know that too.
Yes.
But like a lot of, but a lot of folks would not say no to their dean. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and these are junior faculty members. I'm like, good for you. This is what it looks like to be making your institution like to be radically selfish in this moment. Like what matters is that you can do the work that you care about, that you can expend your energy on things that are more meaningful to you. And maybe that task force would have been meaningful too, but it's not the right time.
Exactly. And probably often I think the reason we don't say no is because we're worried about the negative ramifications. I think sometimes we feel like, oh, well, this is an opportunity I won't get again. But it's like, no, there's always going to be another dean's task force for you to join. And so
totally,
if it's the right time and it makes sense, then and you want to do it, then do it. But if it's not the right time, like good for your client for
but also recognizing that it's not the right time.
Yes.
Because folks just tend to add more and more and more. Yes. And they look at their schedule like 2 months, 3 months from now, and they're like, I have the time. And then it rolls around and they're like, but I never have the time.
Yeah.
And now I'm so far behind. It ends up being like a thing to berate yourself with instead of like a realistic assessment of I never did have the time.
Yes. Right. It's kind of like I had this sort of radical realization that laundry is never done. Like I used to think sometime I would accomplish doing all of the laundry. And then I realized laundry never gets done. The minute you finish that last load, there's more dirty laundry. And so you just have to accept that. And sometimes I think as academics, we need to accept we never check everything off of our to-do list. So imagining that there's some point in the future where your schedule is wide open is sort of an unrealistic expectation, right?
Right. And I think that's just like a human, humans have this like fallacy around time, right? So like the more I read about time or time management, it's like we just always chronically underestimate how long anything takes.
Mm-hmm.
Or like people think they have 8 hours to write, but like they've got a dental appointment, they have to buy groceries and they have to pick up their child. Do they have 8 hours, right? So and it's just like being more realistic.
8 hours. Yeah.
And you totally can't. Well, there's a small minority of people who can. And I will always say there's some people that like they block out their Fridays for writing and they literally write all day. Mm-hmm. It's a minority. Most people just need like If you can create 1 to 2 hours a day, you are doing awesome. And for some folks, that's like a real relief to hear.
Mm-hmm. Even if you can do half an hour some days, it's probably better than nothing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. As long as you can touch it, it's like, can you continually keep working with it? Because your mind will keep chewing on it when you're not working on it.
Well, Leslie, this has been such a fun conversation. And I feel like I got coached by you a little bit in this episode. So hopefully our listeners got a sense of your style and the holistic services you provide around writing, career coaching, and just having a sustainable, and I won't say balanced because there's never a balance, but having a sustainable career as an academic.
I think it's possible. And I also think that academia can be one path or a stepping stone to other great things in your life too. So I think just knowing that the one constant in all of it is you, and you staying as emotionally and physically and other kinds of ways healthy, I think is the most important thing. Because in the end, I don't know, we live longer and longer lives. You can do a lot of stuff in your life, and you might be an academic till the end and you might not, but let's just, as long as you're in it, like, make it worth it.
Yeah, sure. And that way you have the time and energy and health to do other things outside of your job that you enjoy and that, you know, feed your soul.
100%. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you. So Leslie, where can listeners find you if they want to learn more about what you offer?
My website is yourwordsunleashed.com, and same name for my podcast. And I do have an email listserv you can sign up for from my website. And I send out weekly tips and strategies and announcements about my podcast and others. So please join that too.
Okay, great. Well, I will put those links in the show notes. And thanks again for joining me.
Thank you.
I hope you found this episode of Sabbatical 101 helpful and inspirational as you think about your own sabbatical. If you want to read more about sabbaticals or get even more support for planning your own life-changing sabbatical, head over to my website, www.bethanywalinsky.com, to read my blog and for more information about my sabbatical coaching program.